Welcome to Grow Your Influence, leadership conversations for business owners and managers. Whether you own a business and have a team, or leadership is part of your role, welcome, you're exactly where you need to be. Join co-hosts Juliette Robinson and Christy Lee Billett for their regular conversations on all things leadership. No corporate jargon, no textbook ideologies, just real life experience unpacked in a relaxed way to help you be your best boss and lead your team with confidence, clarity, and control. This is Grow Your Influence. Let's dive in.
Hello, and welcome to the Grow Your Influence summer series of interviews. I'm Juliette Robinson, and in the next couple of episodes, I'm talking with David Gillespie. David is the author of a number of books, and some of you might have encountered him years ago when he wrote about sugar in the Sweet Poison books. He's since written a number of incredibly well-researched books on a range of topics, including seed oils, teenagers, our brain, all sorts of things. So I wanted to talk to David about his most recent book, which is called Toxic at Work. He has another book around this topic called Taming Toxic People, which came out a few years ago. Toxic at Work is really a continuation of the research that he'd done, because he wanted to really talk about how this impacts people at work. And I think all of us, when you read the book, all of us have encountered somebody who is completely toxic. David talks about people he describes as psychopaths, and not in the Hollywood version of a psychopath, but in what would now probably be described as a sociopath, sometimes described as a narcissist. There's a whole lot of different titles, but essentially what we're talking about is someone who really doesn't have any empathy. And so they can sort of cut a swathe through your life and everybody else's lives because it doesn't mean anything to them. They're just focused on themselves, and they're not thinking about, and probably don't even notice, the impact they have on your life. And I think when you hear David speak, you'll definitely have someone in mind who you've had to deal with in the past, or may even be dealing with at the moment. So in this interview, we talked for about an hour. So I've broken it down into two episodes. He talks about four questions in the book. The first couple are, you know, what's wrong with this person and why are they doing this to me? And so this first episode will focus on those two aspects. In the second episode, we'll talk about how do I make it stop and how do I avoid it ever happening again? So I really hope you get a lot out of these two episodes. We'll put a link to David's website and to the book. You can find it in any good bookstore. But we'll put all the details in the notes for you to find. And I hope you enjoy. I'd love to hear your feedback. And it always helps us if you can rate or review the podcast. So if you get a chance and if you found this valuable, I'd love you to share it with other people. And I'd love you to give us a review on wherever it is you listen to your podcasts. Thanks. See you soon. Hello there, and welcome to this interview with David Gillespie. David is a former, or as he used to describe himself, recovering corporate lawyer and a co-founder of a software company, and a researcher with a string of titles to his name. I first discovered David when he wrote Sweet Poison back in 2017, and I've followed his various incredibly well-researched projects since then. Somehow I missed Taming Toxic People, David. I'm not sure how that happened when it was first published. So I was really delighted to find it recently, and then to discover your newly released book, Toxic at Work. And ever since I've read it, I wanted to talk to David about his research findings and just to dive into how we deal with toxic people in our lives, because this is something I deal with leaders and their teams all the time. David, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolute pleasure.
Before we get into discussing toxic people, can we talk a little bit about trust and teamwork? As you open with this in your book, and I'm always working with people to help them build trust in their teams, can you just give me a little bit about your take on the importance, I guess, of trust in teamwork and where toxic people fit into that?
Oh, okay. Well, that's a big start, but let's start with that. Okay. Look, if you don't have trust, you don't have a team, you just have a group of people. I use some examples in the book about sports teams, some that have clearly had trust and achieved amazing things, and some that clearly didn't and failed to achieve the things they were expected to do. Trust is a little bit like oxygen. You don't notice it when it's there, but as soon as it's not there, believe me, you'll notice it. And that's the way it works in teams. I'm just
I love
thinking.
that quote that you don't notice it when it's there. It's really when it's not there that it becomes so obvious.
I guess the place to start here is to step back a little bit and talk about why we are the apex predator on this planet. And we are, undoubtedly. But if you took a look at us, me or you or anyone else, you might be surprised at that statement if you're an alien, because you'd notice that we had no talons, no claws, no armor, no venom. In fact, we're pretty puny, not particularly strong by any measure. And there are any number of beasts who could take us one-on-one without any difficulty whatsoever. I know I wouldn't come out ahead of a grizzly bear or a saltwater crocodile or a great white shark. So why aren't they the apex predators, but we are? The answer is pretty simply, we work well in groups. We cooperate. We are the only species on this planet that cooperates with strangers. Every other species or many other species can cooperate within family groups, but they don't cooperate with strangers. And the reason they don't cooperate with strangers is they have no mechanism for trusting strangers. So they have to operate on the basis that a stranger to them, someone who is not related to them, is out to do them harm. And that's the only safe way to proceed. Humans uniquely don't do that. What we do is operate on a default that everyone we meet is honest. And we assume that we're being told the truth by everyone we meet. And when they disappoint us, as they occasionally do, and tell us a lie or aren't as honest as we started out assuming, then we retaliate in kind. But as soon as they start telling the truth again, we start believing them again. And that's a strange mechanism. It doesn't exist anywhere else in nature. Everyone else, every other animal on this planet, uses a mechanism that says, I assume you are going to do me harm and I will act accordingly. Now, if you've worked with people in teams that are competing within the team with each other, you know for a fact what happens is they never achieve anything more than the individuals would achieve themselves, and usually much less because they're getting in each other's way. The teams that outperform are teams that trust every other member of the team to do the thing that they need them to do, so that they can get on with what they need to do. In other words, they operate as an organism which is greater than the individuals, and the output is greater than any of the individuals could do. In other words, the sum is greater than the parts. And the mechanism that we use to do that, we call trust, but it actually has a biochemical basis to it, which we can talk about if you want to.
We'll get to that.
But
Yes, we'll get to that.
we call it trust. And that is that default proposition, which is every stranger I meet, I will assume they have my best interests or the best interests of this team at heart, until I am proven wrong. Now, where psychopaths fit into that is a psychopath is a human that doesn't have that biochemistry for trust. So they don't believe that about other humans. They work on the basis that everybody else is out to get them, and they do their best to protect themselves against other members of the team by driving divisions into the team, knowing that if they get together, they will probably eject the psychopath from the team. So their best defense to that is to make them not trust each other. So psychopaths suck the trust out of a team the way a vacuum sucks oxygen out of a room.
So it's really a divide and conquer strategy, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Yeah. It's definitely unconscious because they've been doing it their entire lives. A person who is psychopathic has been a psychopath since birth, and they have had plenty of time to practice manipulating people to the point where they protect themselves by making them not trust others.
Can we just briefly talk about the term psychopath? Because I think it's in Taming Toxic People. You talk about the fact that this word was sort of hijacked by Hollywood in a way. And so for most people, it's associated with sort of Norman Bates or horror movies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Norman Bates was psychotic. He wasn't a psychopath.
Right.
So the psycho of the movie Psycho is just short for psychosis. Unfortunately, up until that point, the early 50s, the word psychopath didn't mean anything like that. It meant a person who doesn't have empathy. And if you don't have empathy, you can't trust another person. And that's all it meant. So there was no particular stigma associated with it. After Psycho, the word entered the mainstream. Psychopath sounded a lot like psychotic. And the words became associated in people's minds. The profession realized that fairly quickly and started calling the things they'd previously been calling psychopath, sociopath, and even antisocial disorder. And because the thing they were wanting to emphasize is that the failure, the misfiring in the mind of a psychopath is the interaction with others, the social interaction with others, and to be more specific, the empathy trust nexus.
The lack of empathy, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Look, let's get into toxic people. In the book, you talk about four questions. There's what is wrong with this person? Why are they doing this to me? How do I make it stop? And how do I avoid it happening again? Can we perhaps tackle the first two questions, the what is wrong with this person and why are they doing this to me? You talk about the brain chemistry.
Yeah, okay. So the what is wrong with this person comes from the fact that we repeatedly see them doing things which harm the best interests of the team or the organization or the charity or the sports club or whatever it is. You know, humans are grouping together with groups of strangers to achieve something that they themselves can't achieve on their own. Mm-hmm. And everyone is doing it for as long as they see a benefit for the group. So you're joining a sports club, you're helping out on the committee because you want the group to achieve something that you yourself can't do, which might be to, as simple as providing a sporting activity that your kids can be part of. And so when we see an individual within one of those teams do something that preferences an advantage to them over the advantage to the organization, it's confusing to us. When we see someone do something that, even if it's a very, very small advantage, gives them some benefit and takes away from the organization at the same time, then we're mystified by that because we're thinking, well, we're all here for the same thing. We're all here to advance this company or grow this club or grow this charity. Why is that person hurting our common effort by just so that they can get that minor advantage, the corner office or the better parking space or the slightly more pay or whatever it is? And that makes us feel like, I don't understand this. I don't understand what's motivating them. I can't predict them because an essential part of the way we predict what people will do is that we assume we're all trying to achieve the same thing, which is the advancement of whatever group endeavor we're doing. And so that's the first bit. Often because our first encounter with these people was that they were an incredibly positive person, an addition to the team, very charming. They say everything we want to hear. They say and do all the right things. Their resume is perfect. They're, you know, everything about them. And then suddenly they do something which harms the team. And we say to ourselves, what's going on here? So that's why they confuse us. The reason they do that is that they don't see the team. They don't have any sense of there being a team or a common undertaking. All they see in a group of people doing something is an opportunity to benefit themselves.
Yes. And when they're doing that, because we don't understand it, we don't know. We're assuming best intent, as we do, and treating them as though they have best intentions.
Absolutely. And we assume that what they're telling us is the truth.
Yes.
Because we assume that about everybody.
Yes.
And then even when it becomes clear that they aren't telling us the truth, we'll try to justify it to ourselves, try to say, oh, I must have misunderstood them, or maybe I got it wrong, or whatever. We'll do everything other than just do the obvious, which is say, they lied to me. And even when it's clear they did lie to you, all they've got to do is pretend to apologize for it or be ashamed of it, and we put them straight back in the good books.
It's fascinating. I find this fascinating that we constantly try and make adjustments for them because they're not behaving quite like we are.
That's right. Because, well, we want to believe that all humans behave and think the same way we do.
Yes.
Because most do. I mean, 19 out of 20 of us do. It's only 1 out of 20 that has this malfunction, or failure to evolve is probably a better way to describe it. And it's a safe presumption for us that everybody else thinks the way we do.
Mm.
And when we encounter someone who is clearly not thinking the way we do, it is really discordant for us.
Mm.
Initially, we try to blame ourselves and think we must have misinterpreted something. We got something wrong. We're not understanding what's going on here. But eventually we understand that, no, the person is just lying to us all the time. And then that's really distressing.
Can we talk a little bit about the brain chemistry, about why this happens? Because in the book, you talk about how people are, about mirror neurons.
Mm.
And about how people are born this way. This is not something they've learnt along the way.
Yeah, so let's talk about the biochemistry, because I agree with you. It is fascinating. Is how on earth did we evolve something that allowed us to know when to trust another human?
Yes.
And because it can't be wrong. You know, it has to be accurate, because if we trust someone we shouldn't trust, we'll end up dead. So it has to be something that works well. And it's based on an architecture that's present in a lot of animals called the mirror neuron architecture, where we're able to react in sub-second speeds to triggers in the environment that our conscious self is not aware of. So a sound that our unconscious mind is hearing, or a smell, or a movement, or an unusual change in speed, or whatever. Evolution has outfitted all animals with this capacity to pick up these signals and call it a hunch, call it a gut feel, whatever you want. But that's what's going on. And it's been tested extensively, particularly surprisingly in baseball studies. So there's obviously a lot of money in baseball.
Yes, I saw that.
because you've got about 300 microseconds between when a ball leaves the pitcher's hand and when it hits the bat. And so there's been a lot of work put into what happens in that 300 microseconds and why some people can hit the balls and some people can't. And so a lot of work there tells us that we're picking up just slight changes in angle of the pitcher's arm, the way the ball moves in the air, stuff that if you asked a batsman to write down or a batter to write down, they wouldn't be able to, but their brain is picking it up, and it's using that same network. Now, what we've done unusually for humans, so most animals do that. What we've done, and you know most animals do that because you'll see herd animals behave this way, that, you know, a group of gazelle or something, suddenly one is startled and the whole lot is off charging across the plain. And that's not because all of them saw whatever startled that first one, but because their mirror neurons did the work. So we have that architecture, but we did something special with that architecture. We added a layer onto it using something called the von Economo neuron network. And it is a long spindle neuron that connects our amygdala, the bit of us that responds to that mirror neuron trigger, up to our forward, most recently evolved part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, which does all kinds of simulations and assessments of that. And this is the bit where we are unique among species on this planet. Everyone else, or most other species, have those neurons, but they use them for other things. So dogs have adapted those to differentiate smells, which, you know, they have a sense of smell which is 1,000 times more powerful than us. So they're using that same network to, it's a differentiation network. Birds do it so that to differentiate eyesight. So that's why they can see at 1200 frames per second, whereas we can only see at 60 frames per second, something that's necessary if you're flying at 60 or 80 kilometers an hour through branches. Those sorts of things, other species have adapted that network to do that differentiation. We took ours and adapted it to the thing that's most important to us being an apex predator, social differentiation. And what that looks like is we take that input from the mirror neurons about everything we see another person doing, or the way their face reacts, the way they look, the way they move, the way they smell, everything. And we pump that into this mirror neuron network and we do some calculations on their emotional state. And we take their emotional state into account in assessing the way we should behave. Now, we have a term for that in lay English. It's called empathy. We can see each other's thoughts and we take each other's thoughts into account in the way we behave. And it's expressed in every major religion and every major philosophy around the world as the golden rule, which is do unto others as you would have done unto you. But that is what we're talking about, which is we moderate how we behave according to the way we perceive others behaving and reacting. Now, we call that empathy, but what it is actually just a way of making strangers cooperate with each other. And once you've got a mechanism to make strangers cooperate with each other, then you can become the apex predator.
Okay. And for people who are psychopaths, this is not, they have von Economo neurons, but not.
No, they don't.
They don't have them at all.
They have the mirror neurons, but they don't have the von Economo neurons.
Right.
And so they can sense what we're thinking.
Yep.
But they can't automatically take it into account.
Yes.
So you see this in action. If you're in a group of people and say something terrible happens to one of them, say you're at the cricket and someone belts a six and it smacks the guy next to you in the head because he's a bad catcher of cricket balls, you feel it almost as much as he does.
Yes.
That's the von Economo network working. That's you feeling what that person feels. If you are a psychopath, you can see it happen. You can say to yourself, that probably hurts, but you don't feel it. And it's that difference in automated sub-1 second intuition that is the difference between a psychopath and everybody else. Because a psychopath can't feel what you feel, they don't care what you feel. So they are back to pre-empathy humans, where they cannot take account of the damage that is likely to occur to another person in their actions. It's not that they are setting out to be evil. It's that they're not even evil. They just can't take it into account without some sort of manual override. And what that looks like is, for particularly intelligent psychopaths, is them thinking, gosh, that probably did hurt that fellow. I should show him some sympathy. And that's what's called cognitive empathy. And intelligent psychopaths can do it. Mm-hmm. It's a reasonable facsimile of real empathy, but it is not in real time. It is not at the speed of light. And the shift between real-time emotional empathy, where you're actually feeling what the other person's feeling and deciding to feel what the other person's feeling, is a discernible gap that our mirror neurons do pick up, by the way, and which you will feel as a hunch is there's just something off about that guy.
I think that's what I love about your books is you're able to articulate that sense that we sometimes have of there's just something wrong and I don't understand what it is.
And most people don't trust it. Because
No.
remember, we default to trust. We default to believing that we've got it wrong. We default to believing that the other person is as honest as we are.
I loved your examples in the book about Donald Trump on the day of the Twin Towers attack. And his focus was on the fact that his tower was now going to be the highest
tallest.
again. Yeah, the tallest. Yes.
Yeah, and you see that over and over again with him. And look, people think I'm picking on Donald Trump. It's just that he's a very, very high profile person. So there's a lot you can look at. And he's clearly psychopathic. And it is great to have so many visual examples. Even that one you're talking about was actually recorded live on air. So you see in real time the way a psychopath thinks, which is, they're not thinking about the emotional impact. Everybody else is looking at a tower collapsing with 2,000 or 3,000 people in it, and they're just emotionally devastated by that. It's why all of us can remember what we were doing and where we were when that happened, because it's a massive emotional print. But for a psychopath, none of that's there. They're just seeing a fact. Oh, a tower has fallen down. Oh, that means my tower, which was previously the second highest, is now the highest. And to the rest of us, that looks criminally evil. But to the psychopath, it's just observing a fact without regard to the emotional waves that are around it, because they simply can't see them.
So the second question you put in your book is, why are they doing this to me? And I think what I read in the book is that there is no grand plan. They don't tend to have a grand plan. They're just focused on themselves.
Yes.
And if you get in the way, or if they can use you in some way, they will, because of this lack of empathy.
That's right. So they're the ultimate in selfish person.
Yes.
So the reason they're confusing to us is that everybody else isn't. Everybody else takes account of the needs of others and moderates their behavior accordingly. And they assume everyone else is operating to the same rules. So when someone comes in who isn't operating to those rules at all, they've got a very simple plan, which is, whatever option puts the most benefit in my pocket is the only option I need to consider. There's no grand strategy. There's no thinking ahead in time. There's none of that. It's simply moment by moment, what is the option between the ones presented to me at this second in time that gives me the most benefit? And people say, why do psychopaths lie all the time? Donald Trump, for example, you know, the Wall Street, I think it was the Washington Post, counted 30,000 lies in the 4 years that he was president. And that's probably not exceptional. It's just that people were counting with him. For a psychopath, a lie doesn't have the same meaning as it does for the rest of us. To the rest of us, a lie is something you have to really bunch up your fists and grit your teeth and think, oh, I really need to tell this mistruth in this situation. I hope I get away with it. Psychopaths are not thinking any of that. They're just saying, well, this person in front of me needs to hear A or B. A benefits me more than B does, so I'll tell them A.
Right.
Does A happen to be true? Who cares? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It doesn't matter as long as it benefits me.
And they don't have remorse about lying in the way.
They have no past and no future. So they're the ultimate Zen in the sense that they live in the moment. So there's a great study that I talk about in the book where they sat down some psychopaths and some non-psychopaths in a device where they hooked them up to an electric current. And they said to them, look, we're going to count down from 8 seconds to zero. And when we get to zero, we're going to give you a really nasty electric shock. It's really going to hurt. And it won't kill you, but it is going to hurt. And then they put, you know, skin conductance measures and things on them so that they could measure the degree to which they were having anxiety about this. And then they did it, counted down. And as promised, when they hit zero, they gave them electric shock. And yes, it was extremely painful. So
I hope this is one of those paid studies that, you know.
Oh, yeah, it was a paid study.
No.
This was actually, it was done on prisoners.
Yes,
they were paid. And it was done multiple times. And so, all right. So the first time they did it, obviously, some people were getting quite nervous because, but once they knew how bad the shock was, when they said, well, we're going to do it again now, then the non-psychopaths started to get very, very stressed. The closer the count got to zero, they knew what was coming. They were stressed, really stressed. But the psychopaths, interestingly enough, were not at all concerned. So they didn't show signs of anxiety, even though they just experienced the same thing as the other people. They knew what was coming, but they weren't concerned about it. Psychopaths do not fear consequences. They work on the basis of what will happen will happen. It will happen or it might not happen. You never know. There's absolutely no point worrying about it. And that's because the part of our brain that builds in the learning mechanism for consequences, which is the bit we learn when we're young, don't touch the hot stove, that bit is run by the same network that handles empathy. Because psychopaths don't have that, they have no fear of the future because they don't fear consequences. It's why you cannot punish a psychopath.
Yes.
Prisons the world over have discovered many, many times they are not responsive to punishment. You either do or you don't do, but threatening a psychopath will not get you anywhere.
I think that's fascinating. And I there was two things that really struck me, that the youth justice center, Mendota.
Yes, Mendota.
Where they recognized this and did some work around using rewards rather than punishment. And that seems to have had some success.
Yes, the only way to get a psychopath to change what they were going to do is to reward them for a pathway that you want them to take. Remembering that the fundamental equation to a psychopath is which of the options in front of me gives me a greater reward. If the mechanism is the reward, then you can get them to do whatever you want. Mm. And it's helpful to think of them like dogs in that sense. Dogs, by the way, are also psychopaths. And they work on the same basis, which is if you want a dog to do something, reward it.
Yes.
Punishing
don't
a dog.
Punish it for the bad behavior, reward it for the good behavior.
Exactly. Anyone who trains dogs will tell you which is likely to be more effective. Punishing a dog for bad behavior just makes the dog furtive and aggressive, whereas providing them with rewards for the things you want them to do gets them to do what you want them to do. And Mendota did that on a large scale over many years, still continues to do it with psychopathic juvenile delinquents or juvenile inmates, and has measurable success with that system. It is not permanent. It does not cure them of psychopathy, but it does improve outcomes.
Yeah. And look, and from what you're saying, there is no cure as such.
There isn't.
No.
There's just control.
Yes.
Right. And reality. And one of the realities that everyone has to accept is that 1 in 20 humans are psychopaths. That means that if you have an organization that has more than 20 people in it, then you are employing psychopaths. And your challenge as an organizational leader is to design your organization to cope with that reality rather than break because they're there.
And I think you said in Taming Toxic People, is it 1 in 7 at the sort of C-suite level, at the executive level?
It's about 30%. So there's been quite a lot of studies on this. It's about the same as in the prison population, so about 30%.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on this episode. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a rating, comment, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to recommend us to a friend. We also love hearing suggestions for topics or guest speakers that you would love to hear from. The best way to reach us to give us those suggestions is over on our Facebook page. Simply head to Facebook and search Grow Your Influence. See you there.